And welcome, listeners, to another edition of the KGOU Readers Club, today featuring the new book, Here Today, which documents at least some of the ghost towns, abandoned places, vanishing places, small towns hanging on in Oklahoma. I'm KGOU Managing Editor Logan Layden. The book is from the University of Oklahoma Press. The author is Jeffrey Smith, who joins me in studio for the next hour. Jeff, thanks for joining me today.
Logan, I'm so happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Of course. Just finished up the book yesterday myself. Here Today is really more of it's not a novel. It's a guide, basically. Why don't you just at the very beginning here, tell us just a little bit about the book overall, what it is. What are you going to get if you get Here Today and take a read?
Well, so Here Today is the kind of book that I do not recommend reading all in one sitting or one weekend. It's 100 different towns in Oklahoma, small towns, 500 persons or less, that have experienced a great decline since their peak, and they meet some other criteria, including being relatively accessible and interesting to me. Other people may have picked different towns, for example, but it's the kind of thing, each chapter is about 3 or 4 pages long, so I don't think you want to read hundreds of pages per day. But like, this is the kind of thing you read one chapter, two chapters a day, or maybe when you're going to that town, and you'll learn all about the town founder and the origins and why the town came to be, what was there, what was unique about it, some of the key highlights during the town's existence, and then what you might find today if you go there on a visit, for example. I try to note some key spots, historical places, GPS coordinates, and then I kind of bring it all together at the end. And I talk about the town founders, what happened to them, where they are, where they ended up later in life.
Well, it's a particularly interesting subject for me as a reporter. Earlier in my career, went all around the state and passed through so many of the towns that you talk about here in the book, passed through them. And you know, you get that they're each and every one of these places has its own unique history. But there are some themes. We'll get into all of that. But let's first talk about sort of your motivations for this book and you yourself. You're here with me in studio today. Oftentimes we do these shows via Zoom or even over the phone, but you're conveniently located here at the University of Oklahoma. What do you do aside from writing books like this?
Well, this is something really different for me. I'm an associate professor of marketing and innovation here at the University of Oklahoma. I've been here for 19 years. I've been a business professor for nearly 30 years. So this is very different from what I typically do. But I got fascinated in this topic about 25 years ago. My first academic job was at Kansas State University. And so I moved to lovely Manhattan, Kansas, and I had a great time there. But I grew up in Metro Detroit, and Metro Detroit is so much different than Kansas. So when I moved there, I was just completely enthralled to see these little towns of 10 or 50 or 500 people. And it was like going back in time, sometimes 50 or 100 years. And so I just started going to these places on the weekends for entertainment and just something to do. And I stumbled across a really interesting book called Ghost Towns of Kansas. And I literally got a map and a highlighter because this is before we had GPS. And I would just travel to these places to learn about what used to be. I never liked history as a kid or in high school or college, but living right off the Oregon Trail and seeing history was much more interesting than reading about it in a textbook, for example. Then I left Kansas and I went to Illinois. I didn't do a lot of ghost town hunting for a while. And then I came to Oklahoma in 2005. And once again, I was surrounded by all these very cool small towns that were declining from their peak, but still vibrant in some cases and interesting. And I found John Morris's book, Ghost Towns of Oklahoma. And so for the last 18, 19 years, I've been driving around Oklahoma to small towns to check them out when I'm on my way other places. My oldest son was in Boy Scouts, and so we would take detours and I would drag him to a lot of these places and take pictures. And what happened is through my social media, people learned that I like to go to these places and research them and take pictures. And so the OU Press in 2020 called me up and said, hey, we've got a proposition for you. How would you like to update John Morris's classic Ghost Towns of Oklahoma book? And that book is about 45 years old. It's super well done, but a lot of things have changed with regard to those towns and technology in the last 50 years. And so I thought there was a real opportunity to create a book that's much, much different than the original book, no less important and hopefully more so, but for the next 50 years. And so this is the kind of book that you do once and hopefully for the next 30 or 40 or 50 years, I don't need to do it again. But it's going to kind of document what is, and of course, as time goes by, some of these things will no longer be in the same condition that they're in now. But super excited to kind of contribute to the state knowledge and tourism and get people to learn about places and visit places. And even if you're from one of these 100 towns in the book, you probably don't know a lot about your town going back 125 years ago. So I've dug through the newspapers and various archives. We could talk about that maybe more. But it's been the funnest professional thing I've ever done.
Well, it must have taken a really long time. You highlight 100 towns in here today, but there was a process that you went through to select those. I mean, if you tried to do a guide to all of the vanishing places, all of the ghost towns in Oklahoma, the book would be 6 feet high. How did you sort of narrow things down? I know you had some criteria when it came to what you were going to include in the book.
Logan, the most difficult part of the process was trying to figure out what towns I wanted to include. And I spent 4 years on this project. I guess I started with, I think John Morris has 130, 135 towns in his book. I started with those towns. Mm-hmm. Then I got census data from the U.S. Census, and I actually plotted trend lines through thousands of towns and looked for the ones that are shrinking. And then I had to have some criteria in terms of size, so I picked towns that are currently 500 people or less. And there were some other criteria, too, in terms of when it peaked and how easy the town is to access. So I started off with a list of probably around 1,200 towns, got down to 800 fairly quickly. From there, narrowed it down to about 400, looked at a lot of satellite images, looked at a lot of other data. And then I got in my car and I went to like more than 300 places. And so if I wrote the biggest thing I'm finding on social media is people saying, hey, you missed this town or you missed that town. I missed thousands of towns because there's probably 2,500 or 3,000 towns I could have put in the book because a lot of those towns are not here. There's nothing left. So I went to a lot of the towns in John Morris's book, and it's not that exciting to drive 30 or 40 miles down a dirt road to find a cornfield. It's just not that interesting. And so all the towns that are in here today, there's something still left to see. There might be people, there might be a school, there might be a post office, there might be some abandoned buildings. So some people are disappointed their town is in the book because my town's not a ghost town. And some people are upset their town is not in the book because they want the publicity. I'm not trying to offend anyone. In fact, I'm trying to do just the opposite. I'm trying to preserve and document what's there. And I really want people to get out with their dogs and their kids and their spouses and visit these places and spend some money on gas or go to a restaurant if a restaurant exists in these towns. And just, I call it micro tourism. Instead of going to Europe or going to Florida or Colorado, get in your car, you got 2 hours to kill, stop and get a burger someplace, or on the way to Colorado, stop, or on the way to grandma's house, stop and learn about, talk to some local people and just see what's there. Because I think we get on the highways and we get to go 75 miles an hour and we don't go to see all the really cool things that are still left around us if we just get off the highways just for a little bit.
Yeah, stop and get a burger in Mears, one of my favorite stops. Talk about in the book. And for you, this what you mentioned, getting with your family, with your dog. This is exactly what you did. This was kind of a family affair for you. And I think the dog was along for a lot of the ride.
The dog traveled more miles than any other human besides me, and he had a lot of hamburgers in a lot of small towns. But it was great to create memories with my three children and friends and of course my dog tagged along. But it was the funnest thing I've ever done professionally, and I think it's really deeply it changed me as a person writing this book. In all honesty, it changed the way I view myself as a professor and a researcher. You know, some of my colleagues around the country think I was probably foolish for doing this because in my academic field, books don't count, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Journal articles count. And, you know, so I don't think this was really highly encouraged by some people in my inner circle. Other people said if it's fun and it's interesting and you think it's meaningful, you should do it. And I'm just delighted I did. I didn't know it would take me 4 years. I didn't know it would be this big of a project. I'm immensely proud of the book, though. OU Press did a great job. When you hold it in your hand, I think it feels good. I think it looks good. And most importantly, I think it's really, really a high-quality product. They had all kinds. We had professional cartographers making the maps. We had an indexer making the index. We had graphic artists laying out the pictures and the cover, for example. And so the book came out better than I could have even hoped. And when I first held it in my hands a few weeks ago, I was beaming ear to ear because it was such a culmination of 4 years, and really more than that if you think about all the time I spent before I officially started working on the book. I've probably taken over 10,000 pictures. I've logged more than 8,000 miles, and that's the ones I can document. So it's been a real journey to produce this this book here today.
Well, it's about not forgetting that these places existed. And this is a book, at least from my perspective, that seems to be intended to sort of stand the test of time, at least for a few decades. You mentioned Ghost Towns of Oklahoma being sort of an inspiration for this. You know, that book is from the 70s, and a lot has changed. And I'm sure a lot will change between now and 2060, 2070, before someone goes back and looks again. But it really is a guide. So if this is something that interests the listeners out there, this is a good book to pick up to be able to sort of point you in the direction that you want to go. And you span all parts of the state with this. 8,000 miles, I think?
8,000 miles.
Yeah.
8,000 documented miles. I'm sure it was more than that, but I didn't keep great records sometimes.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk a little bit about small towns in Oklahoma in general. What we see, and we know that every one of these communities has a unique history of their own. And it can sort of put things, I don't know, in perspective a little bit as you read through this. Every one of these towns had founders, had people who were building this. This was going to be the next Chicago. This is going to be the next major city. And you'll find there that a lot of these town founders are buried in local cemeteries, sometimes out in the middle of nowhere. And it sort of makes you think a little bit. These were once prominent people naming towns after themselves, and even at the end of the day, they end up in a grave in the middle of nowhere.
It puts life for me. This put life in perspective. It really did. It's really surreal to go to a town, and I did. I try to bring the people aspect in more than it's been done typically in this genre of books. And I, you know, I figured out who the town founder and who the first postmaster was and what happened to them. And a lot of times, probably half the time, they never ventured very far from the towns they founded. In fact, sometimes they're still buried in that town cemetery. And so you're standing on the founder's grave, looking at his or her, you know, headstone. And, you know, they were, in some cases, very successful, very wealthy, very powerful people. And but you realize that, unfortunately, none of us last all that long in the big scheme of human existence. And it does kind of make you feel really small in some cases, right? I definitely wanted to kind of bring in the human element. What happened to the people that started the town? You know, some of them went on to start other towns. Some of them became immensely successful and wealthy. And some of them stayed in that same town for 40 or 50 years and eventually passed away and is, you know, still buried in that town.
And while each of the towns are unique and have their own unique histories, there are themes. Why do you start a town? If you're in Oklahoma 125 years ago, why would you do that? And there are several reasons why. Some of them spring to mind instantly. If you've got a railroad intersection in that area, that's a good place for a town. If it's near a river, that's a good place for a town. But then there are others. I was particularly interested in these whiskey towns, and you document a few of those in the book. Where did those spring from? You might have a town that has a couple of hundred people that's got multiple saloons. Talk a little bit about those.
You know, this is kind of where my business, you know, my marketing expertise comes in, right? You know, so if you think back in time, before statehood in 1907, Oklahoma was divided into two parts, right? Oklahoma Territory and Indian Territory. And so in Oklahoma Territory, liquor was legal. And in Indian Territory, it was not, it was illegal to sell liquor. And so so a lot of these whiskey towns, they literally set up right across the territory line between Oklahoma and Indian Territory. And they really targeted Native Americans who had never experienced alcohol before. And so they would have 5, 6, 7, 10, 12 saloons in a town of 50, 500 people. Sometimes the saloons are in tents. And what would happen is the Native American folks would walk across the low river. They would go across a bridge. They would wade across a river if it wasn't too deep. And they would get alcohol. And then they would walk back into Indian Territory. You know, on one hand, I think this is like genius marketing because you've got a group of adults that want to consume something and they have money or goods to trade for it. And it makes immense business sense. On the other hand, I'm conflicted because you're kind of introducing a product to people that have never experienced this before and have, in some cases, a proclivity to be genetically disposed to have problems with that product. And so it's, on one hand, a great business kind of thing, and on the other hand, kind of a tragedy for humankind. And so I'm conflicted about that. But there are a bunch of these whiskey, and they're not that far away. Lexington, Oklahoma, for example, or Purcell, those aren't far from Norman, where we are right now. Those were whiskey towns, for example. And there's a bunch more. Some of them are included in Killers of the Flower Moon, like Rolfton up that way in Osage. But they were towns that were set up to provide a product that you couldn't get just across the border. Not unlike we see some casinos in Oklahoma mm-hmm. doing down by the Texas line, right? So I guess things kind of come full circle, and we find this tendency of humans to target people that want to consume something and it's not legal to do where they live. And so they set up opportunities just across the border to let people consume the goods or services they kind of want.
And they would end up having a school, a post office, being a legitimate community, but not sustainable over the course of time. You know, we had Prohibition, of course, that hurt these whiskey towns because then it was illegal everywhere.
Right. And after 1907, you know, when we became a state, right, then, of course, you were allowed to sell liquor in Indian Territory because it was all Oklahoma Territory or Oklahoma State at that point. And then Prohibition, of course, you know, caused problems for that market, you know, et cetera. But the whiskey towns are really interesting, and there's maybe 7 or 8 of them documented in the book, for example.
Well, that's just one of the themes. We'll get into a few more coming up next. We're going to take a quick break. This is the KGOU Readers Club. I'm managing editor Logan Layden. I'm with author Jeff Smith, and he has written the book Here Today, which was just released, even as we had this conversation just a few days ago. We'll get into more after this. And we're back with the KGOU Readers Club. I'm Logan Layden, managing editor for KGOU, and I'm with Jeff Smith, the author of Here Today, which documents Oklahoma's ghost towns, vanishing towns, abandoned places, and places that are continuing to hang on to this day. We talked a little bit about whiskey towns a little while ago. One of the other sort of themes in the book is you seem to have really made an effort to document some of these towns that were all black towns in early Oklahoma. Tell me a little bit about your experience in those places. You don't include them all. Some of them aren't vanishing places or abandoned places. Boley is a place that I've been that's still a town, but there are others that I had just never heard of before, and more than I thought that there were originally.
That is true. Oklahoma had more all black towns than any other state in the U.S.
Why?
You know, this was kind of, well, I think there's a couple of reasons. I think that this was the land of opportunity, right? There wasn't a long history. Like a lot of states had towns 400 years ago. Oklahoma did not have towns that long ago. So it was kind of an open territory to build. We took the land from people too. So we were able to reallocate it. And it came about, in the late 1880s, 1890s, not far after the Civil War. So we have, a lot of black folks that are escaping slavery and they're looking for a better life and they're being persecuted. And so they come to Oklahoma and they get to start a new existence free from some of the problems maybe they had before. So it was just the right time and the right place and the right opportunity. The name All Black Towns is a little bit of a misnomer. They were never only occupied by black residents. But that's the current name of the town. That's what we currently call them, All Black Towns. They were never all black. They're certainly not all black anymore. But we still have about 13 or 14 of those towns left in Oklahoma. I've been to all of them. Interestingly, not a single one of those towns made it in John Morris's book. And I think there's some reasons. I don't think it's because, he was purposely excluding those towns. I think there was a reason for it. We can talk more about that later. But I think they're really important for our history. And so I went to all 14 of them. As you mentioned, Boley is a thriving town. I mean, it's got a prison there. And I went to the police station. I talked to two lovely police officers. One was white and one was black. And they were getting along great. And it was actually a nice little town. So I like Boley. Langston, I did not include. Right. Langston has a university. Of course, Langston University is there. Oklahoma's only historically black college and university. And so I did not include Langston. I did not include IXL. IXL is debatable if it's ever really been a town per se, and there's really not much there to see anymore, right? It only incorporated in the last 20 or 30 years. But all the other all-black towns, I include the ones that still exist, I included them all. Some of them would not have made the book because there's not a lot left to see in some of them, but they're so historically important, I just think I had to include them, right? Because they're never going to be replicated again, hopefully. And I just think it's important to document them because they're so unique. And so I got to tell you, though, when I go to some of these places, you can still see the vestiges of the past. Like, for example, the roads sometimes going into these all-black towns, they're terribly maintained. There's potholes. They haven't been paved in 40, 50, 60 years. You almost need a truck or at least to drive slowly because the roads are really impassable. The street signs in some cases are so faded you can barely see the names of the street signs, et cetera. There's one town, Brooksville, not far from here, that only got electricity in 1966, which I know that seems like a long time ago to some people, but I was born in 1966. It doesn't seem that long ago to me. And, whereas most towns in Oklahoma had gotten power, in 1905, 1910, 1915, this is 1966. I can't imagine not. How do you have a school with no electricity? How do you have any industry with no electricity?
In the 50s and the 60s?
In the 50s and the 60s. By this point, people were getting TVs and even color TVs, and they don't have electricity yet, so that's kind of a problem. But I've been to all the all-black towns. I've talked to some of the residents there. Lima, for example, is a super interesting place that's got a massive school that's ready to fall apart. It's the last remaining Rosenwald school in the state of Oklahoma, and at least as far as the all-black towns go. And there's 60 people left in Lima, Oklahoma.
And let's do talk about that for a moment. That was a new thing for me as I read this book. The Rosenwald Fund. Talk a little bit about that. They were building schools, and it was primarily in these all-black communities, yes?
So, yes and no. So Rosenwald, he was the president and eventually the chairperson of Sears and Roebuck Corporation. I read a little bit just today about how that came to be, but he got incredibly wealthy. Sears was very successful. When the United States Postal Service started Parcel Post, Sears took advantage of that. So Sears was able to sell stuff now, through catalogs. This is way before the internet, right? But they were selling tons of stuff through catalogs, including entire houses and house kits. And so, Rosenwald made a lot of money. And so he was Jewish, and he understood kind of the plight of other groups that are disenfranchised, unfortunately. And he took a particular liking to poor folks and to black folks, and he wanted to make their lives better. And so he started the Rosenwald Fund, and he invested money in building schools, mostly in the South part of the U.S., and mostly in poor places, including a lot of poor all-black towns. And so in Oklahoma, he built over 200 schools in Oklahoma alone. He built over 5,000 schools across the country. And I did some math this morning. It ended up being almost $1.5 billion in today's dollars, which is just a massive amount of wealth transferred. So he built a lot of schools, including one in Lima, Oklahoma. And the school is it's a massive school, but it's just about in ruins. It's barely standing up. But it was a gorgeous building back in the day, 100 years ago. And Lima doesn't have any schools, but New Lima, right next door, does have schools. And that's kind of a different story. But so Rosenwald did a lot of really neat things for a lot of people around the country.
Mm. Yeah, and we see those mentioned peppered throughout the book here, these Rosenwald schools. And we know, and we're going to talk about this shortly, just the importance of schools for the existence of these towns. And we see sort of what happens whenever you lose the school. It kind of the town goes in a similar direction. As far as all black towns, one thing that also kind of stood out to me a little bit, you hear about white communities. You know, black people wouldn't be allowed to be around after dark. I've never heard it in the opposite until I read the entry for Tatum's or Tatum.
Yep.
I guess the
Tatum.
Essence yep. is silent.
Correct.
Where white people weren't allowed to be around town after dark. Is that right? How did you learn about that?
You know, I guess, you know, in retaliation to some of the sundown towns, a small number of the predominantly black towns had the same kind of deal. You know, if you're white, you need to be out of town by sundown. You know, obviously, we're living in a much different day, you know. Yeah. I was a little shocked, too. And the way I found out about that is, you know, a lot of the research I did for this book involved digging through newspapers. And so I would dig through newspapers. And you know, there's 100, 125 years of newspapers per town. It was a lot. And I'm trying to find the two or three or four most interesting stories over a 100-year period. It was very tedious to look through. So when I came across, you know, interesting facts, like this is a sundown town, but it's for white people, you have to leave before sundown. I thought that was kind of interesting because I always heard about it being the other way, and I'm sure that it probably was the other way a whole lot more. But yes, a small number of black towns had the same kind of views that if you look different than me, you better be gone before the day's over.
Yeah. So we see, you know, these motivations for these towns getting started, whether it's the ones that immediately come to mind, like a railroad intersection or a river or resources, like for a town like Pittsburgh down in southeast Oklahoma, where there was coal mining, but also with the black towns, just the, well, and of course, they, you know, located those towns in the areas that they did for particular reasons, economic reasons, but also focused on having a chance at freedom and to sort of escape the wider racism in the country. And some of them still hang on today, or at least there are at least remnants of them. One thing I did want to ask you about that I found particularly interesting was oftentimes as you read the entries for the towns, you'll see, well, this town was founded in this area, but then they moved it over here. And that seems, did they physically like take the buildings and put them in a different place? I see several examples of towns being moved in the book. Seems like almost a common occurrence.
I, you know what? I would say that at least 40% of the towns in the book moved over their existence. Sometimes they moved two or three or four times over their existence. Mm-hmm. Now, today, that seems like, to me, unfathomable. It's almost mind-boggling.
If we're going to move Norman 3 miles south.
And that's what they – back in the day, that's what they did.
Yeah.
You know, it could be they have a town – and they kind of like figure out where the railroad may come through. So they build a town and they're wrong, and the railroad comes 3 miles south of where the town is. Well, the town knows we're going to die. Without the railroad, we're not going to make it. We have to move the town 3 miles south. And they literally get a bunch of draft horses, and they move all the buildings 3 miles south. I've seen some pictures. It must be incredibly difficult. You know, but again, the buildings back then had no foundations. They were just kind of laid on the ground. And there was no indoor plumbing. There was no electricity. So there was no wiring. There was no sewage. So they just picked the buildings up and moved them inch by inch 3 miles south. And by the way, it's really hard to kind of figure out where they are, because that land has been returned to agricultural use. And so I found a newspaper article. The town moved 1.5 miles south. And I'm looking at satellite images trying to find out if I can see where it was. And in some cases, I can't. But again, the town moved 2 or 3 or 4 times over its history. The river dries up, the train comes in, a highway goes a different direction than they thought, and they pick up the entire town and they move it. And so you might be living in a town, you don't even realize that the town moved, you know, 80 years ago, a couple miles away. But it's almost, in this day and age, hard to understand. How can you move the entire town? But they did. They moved the entire town.
Yeah. We have one of our reporters, Beth Wallace, our education reporter for State Impact, who recently moved into an older house up northwest of Tulsa in a very small town that's name escapes me at the moment, but thought that the house was built in like 1918 or 20, but turned out that it was built before that. It was just moved to that new location. That seems so crazy nowadays to think of just, well, you know, we need to get this town a couple more miles in this direction. Let's lift up all the buildings and move them down there on these primitive roads. I mean, that must have been just a huge undertaking.
I can't even imagine. And you know, then on top of all that, sometimes they even change the name of the town. You know, we've got a town changing names, or you've got the East Duke versus West Duke. And
they fought.
And they you got to remember that the people that bought the land and platted the towns and started selling lots, their goal is to make money. And so if a train comes through and it misses the town, they're going to like lose all their – nobody is going to want this land. And so like they would burn down post offices of neighboring towns. They would steal the county records in some cases. They would literally have gunfights. I mean like it was a matter of life and death. If your town isn't going to make it, you might lose your entire life savings or more. And people fought vigorously to keep their towns alive.
Well, we're going to talk a little bit more in the last segment here about we've talked about how these towns sort of came to be, but some of the reasons why they ended up in decline. And there are some themes there as well. I've got Jeff Smith with me. He's the author of Here Today, the new book from OU Press. I'm Logan Layden, KGOU Managing Editor. This is the KGOU Readers Club. It's the KGOU Readers Club. Thank you, listeners, once again for joining us. I've got Jeff Smith. He is the author of Here Today from OU Press, documenting ghost towns, vanishing places, abandoned places in Oklahoma, and also places that are still hanging on to this day. You mentioned early on in our conversation, some people were upset that their towns were included in this list. And I'm from McAllister down in southeast Oklahoma, and you document several towns in that area, including places like Pittsburgh and Indianola, which Indianola has a modern school and a basketball team, and never thought of it as a ghost town. But historical buildings, history behind it. You don't just document towns that have disappeared. You also document towns that are hanging on even into the modern era. And we've talked about why towns are where they are, why they came to be. Why are so many of these places vanishing places? What happened to them? And there are a couple of themes in the book related to that. Well, multiple themes. I want to talk a little bit have you talk a little bit about the importance of two things for a town, a post office and schools. It seems like without either of those things, your town is sort of destined to fall into this category of vanishing place.
Yeah, I think you're right. There's lots of reasons towns don't make it, but the post office closing and the school closing, those are the two big killers, you know, for sure. You know, the post office kind of establishes a town. Like that's mm-hmm. that's the beginning of a town, right? That's when the federal government formally recognizes this place as being a real place. And a lot of times they were in tents or they were in the back of someone's sod house. I mean, we don't think about post offices like this. We also don't think that post offices back in the old days, they were the only means to communicate with the rest of the world. There was no radio. There was no TV. Of course, there was no internet. The only way you had to get information was to send a letter or maybe send a newspaper or magazine. And so the post office was critical to establishing a town. And the postmaster, he had tremendous influence over possibly naming the town. And they were also kind of a pillar of society because they were sending money. There was no other way to, there was no wire transfer. So he or she had to be really honest because they could steal a lot of money if they weren't honest. And so the post office was incredibly important to the town. When the post office goes away, the town diminishes. And about a dozen years ago, the U.S. federal government stopped closing post offices to the same extent, and they cut the hours back. And I've got a table in the book, and it shows the number of hours that post offices are opened in these 100 towns. And they went from 8 hours a day to 6 or 4 or sometimes even 2 hours a day. And I think that's a much better move because the post office hangs on. And even though you and I don't go to the post office all that often, perhaps, but in a small town, it's the center. It's the only thing in some cases that kind of brings the community together if the school's gone. So people go there to check their post office box and they talk to their neighbors and they get the latest hubbub of what's happening. And it's how and where they connect, right? There may not be a church. There may not be a school. There's a post office. It's really important for a small town. And the school is the same way, right? The school is, you know, once you lose the school, the younger parents, they move away, right? Because they want to be able to take their kids to school in a 5-minute drive or a bus ride and not a 45-minute bus ride or car ride. And so I've been in so many abandoned schools across Oklahoma that are just left there with books on the shelf, with desks, with computers, with records on the – I mean, it's amazing the waste and the chalkboards that are sitting there. And I wish they could repurpose some of that stuff because it's just literally going to waste. And now some towns keep the schools locked up and maintained really, really nicely, but they're just sitting there for 30, 40, 50 years unused.
Yeah, and that's – again, there's so many examples in the book here where, you know, you talk about the history of the town – and then the school closed in 1947 or 1953, and then that's kind of it for the town. And as far as the post office goes, I mean, that's obviously super important just for the establishment of the town. And so many towns that you document are named after the first postmaster, maybe one of their children, or maybe the postmaster's wife saw a pretty bird, and now the town's called Redbird.
Yep, that happened.
And so that postmaster had a lot of power and prestige in these little places early on. And even today, you know, clinging to that post office can keep a town alive. I remember myself doing a story about 10 years ago in St. Louis, mm-hmm. not Missouri, St. Louis, Oklahoma, which is over there by Kanawha, where there was talk of that post office being shut down. I think they were able to retain it maybe on the shorter hours that you're talking about. But it was still a nice little community, but partially because the post office gives it legitimacy.
St. Louis is currently open, if I'm not mistaken, 2 hours a day. You mm-hmm. are correct. It went from 8 hours to 2 hours back in 2012. Huh. And St. Louis is one of the 100 towns in the book, for example. And so, you know, some of these towns still have amazing schools. I think about Lomega, mm-hmm. and people may not realize this, but, you know, Lomega is a combination of, Kiel. Kiel became Loyal because Kiel's a German word. It wasn't popular after World War I. So Kiel became Loyal to say, hey, we're loyal to the U.S. And then Omega used to be much, much bigger. And so both of these towns were struggling. They still are struggling. But one town kept the elementary school, one town kept the high school, and they've got beautiful schools from what I see in both places because they've got some pockets of wealth. But the schools are far nicer than you would expect for a town to be in this book. But the population of the town itself is really small. You know, you mentioned St. Louis. Macomb's not far away. Mm-hmm. Macomb's down to like maybe 26 people, but it's got a school there. But again, it draws people from farther away than outside the town. But the post office is just so critical, and the school is just so critical for the town being livable and viable and vibrant.
Yeah. You mentioned these names of these towns, and it sort of strikes my memory as I read the book, a place like Kiel, who changed their name because it was a German name. That was also true in Korn,
yep.
Right, which used to be K-O-R-N.
It did.
It's just Korn, C-O-R-N. But that was because of anti-German sentiment. And yep. We haven't even talked about the Germans. They had a major influence in starting towns in Oklahoma.
The Germans and even some Russian Germans did the same thing, right? So, you know, absolutely. It's and Korn's not in the book, but I've been to Korn. Yeah. Korn's it's a little bit too big to be in the book, but it's a small town, very interesting place with lots to see there, for example. So I wish I could have kept all the towns that I wanted to keep in the book, but the book's already 328 pages long, and nobody wants to buy a book that's 1,000 pages.
You got to make some decisions.
Yeah.
Yeah. So obviously losing school, losing post office, these are kind of death knells for communities. But there are examples of other reasons that towns went into decline. The Great Depression had a major influence on sort of the downturn of many of these communities. Even, you know, World War I did as well. But also fire. Fire is a constant theme in this book. It seems like all these places were catching on fire at one time or the other to various degrees. And that could very well, that can send what was a sort of bustling community in a downward spiral that it never recovers from.
You know, one of the things I did in the back of the book is I have an index by different things to find. So I'm looking at the index, and for sites of a significant fire, it's probably more than half the towns in the book had a significant fire. And some of them had two or three or four fires, right? So, you know, you got to remember, though, too, back then people were heating with oil lamps in a barn sometimes. If you bump that oil lamp, it's going to be a problem. You have a lot of wood construction, you know, and wood in Oklahoma dries out. You know, it's hot here. And so fire is a constant problem. You know, I looked at, like, the insurance fire maps for a lot of towns. And they kind of document all the businesses and a lot of the houses in the town. And that's how I found out, like, what the businesses that were there by looking at the fire maps from 1905 or 1910, for example. But fire was a huge problem. We also didn't have a lot of great firefighting equipment or technology. And so if a fire happened, the town was in trouble.
Yeah, some recovered, some didn't. Another thing, not uniquely Oklahoman, but that we know a lot about, we see a lot of towns getting sent southward because of tornadoes.
So tornadoes, fires, I think, too, one thing is we don't think about is the number of cars increasing so dramatically. You go back in time 70, 80 years ago, people traveled by train, and then car became the preferred mode of personal transportation. And the trains kind of started leaving these towns because we built more highways. And if you weren't on a highway, your town was going to be in trouble because no one's coming to your town to shop or to eat if they're on the highway. So the highways and the highway system, unfortunately, bypassed a lot of small towns and just took away business.
Yeah, you work so hard to make sure your town, even moving it, to get near the railroad tracks. And then we make the transition to automobiles, and they build a highway 20 miles away. And
you know, even one mile away, believe it or not, with no exit, mm-hmm. just kills you. You know, you see all your customers driving by, but they can't get to you, for example. And, you know, the book kind of made me realize, like, how much of life is luck. We want to attribute all our success to our hard work. But, man, you got to have some luck. You know, again, the river dries up, a fire comes in, a tornado, the train doesn't show up, or the highway doesn't have an exit. And suddenly your entire business you've built for 20 or 30 or 40 or 50 years is just gone.
Yeah. Well, you've gone back and you've tried to document as many as you can, at least to a reasonable level here. We've just got a few minutes left, and I do want to just highlight a couple of communities that sort of stuck out to me, and then I'm interested to hear some of the ones that you find the most interesting and give people an idea of what they're going to be reading in the book here. We could spend an hour on each and every one of these communities. We talked about moving buildings. At some point, someone stole the Macomb Jail.
That is true.
Not like a police car or...
No.
Like the building itself.
It's back. but it's a very small metal kind of structure, uh-huh. right? That you probably could get a good-sized tow truck and steal, right? It's fun going in some of these one-room jails. I can't imagine being there in the winter in Oklahoma. they must be uncomfortable. But yeah, this is a metal kind of, it looks like a giant dog kennel, for lack of a better word. And it's back in town, and it's there. You can go check it out. I was there just a few weeks ago, as a matter of fact. I've been there. It's close by. I go there once in a while. But I was just there a few weeks ago, and it's back where it's supposed to be.
Yeah. Macomb, interesting. They're all interesting stories. Sacred Heart. Who knew? I mean, the monastery, how it led to St. Gregory's University, which now itself is closed. And there's some Jim Thorpe connections, right, to that community.
I went to Jim Thorpe Elementary School in Sterling Heights, Michigan, where I grew up. Mm-hmm. I learned a lot about Jim Thorpe. I didn't think I'd ever be, at the church he went to. But he attended church at Sacred Heart. He's got a twin brother, which I didn't know. That must have been a bummer playing one-on-one or basketball, because I think Jim would probably win. And their mother, I think they were both baptized at Sacred Heart, Jim and his brother. And then his mother passed away, and she's buried at Sacred Heart. I actually saw her headstone, which is really surreal. That kind of closure into my life and that kind of history, which I had no idea.
The first female black mayor.
Is it Taft?
It was Taft, I believe. Ah. Yes. Yeah. Yep. Yep.
Well, I'm glad I passed that one. That's good.
President Roosevelt in Roosevelt. You got your Mears. You can go get a burger there now, but at one time they thought this was the next gold rush.
Gold mining town, right? Yeah. Mears is an interesting place. And in fact, it's one of the few books that has towns in the book that has a population of zero. There's no people who live officially in the town limits.
And one that was interesting to me was Shamrock, Oklahoma, which I believe I noted it here at least some point had like 10,000 people in the area.
That's
obviously
true.
Nowhere near that now, but the streets are named. They have like Irish names. Some of the buildings are painted green. They even have a Blarney Stone.
They do. They do. And I talk about Mr. Shamrock in the book, and he was a mayor there for like 30 years, and there's a memorial there for him. But, you know, Shamrock's one of these neat little places. If you get off the beaten path, there's still a lot to see in Shamrock, Oklahoma. There's some old buildings, and there's a museum.
As you look back at your experience documenting these towns, what were a couple that stood out to you as among the most interesting?
I really like Cooperton. The town of Cooperton. It's not far from the Wichita Mountains. I think it's down to maybe 12 people population-wise. But there's a couple churches that are there that are still in pretty good shape. And there was this auto parts store that closed down in the 80s, or garage. And it's full of tools and auto parts. And it's like time stood still. And it's a neat place because there's still a school gymnasium. It's now being used as a garage for some individual. But it's interesting because there was a massive Native American massacre there in the 1820s, which really wasn't all that long ago. And that's kind of it's kind of sacred ground. And then a young boy was walking to school one day, and he found a tusk sticking out the side of a hill. And it was a woolly mammoth. And so they discovered, so people from OU went there and they dug out the woolly mammoth skeleton. And so I think that Cooperton is really neat. I also like Deer Creek. And we know about Deer Creek schools, but Deer Creek is a city that's different from the Deer Creek School District. And there's a little mercantile there. And it's the coolest little building. And when I went to see it, it was falling apart. It was just terrible. But you could see the history in it. And a lady, and I'm thinking her name was Cynthia Webster, but I'm going from memory. She bought it and she redid the building, and it's now a retail store. And I've not been back. I've just seen pictures. But she's transforming that town. Her and a few other people are transforming that town. So that store is like a gem in Oklahoma. It's really interesting from what I see. And so, I mean, there's hope for some of these places, right? There's hope to kind of revitalize them or get them to grow. Maybe some people could move to some of these places and kind of reverse the trend. But those two stick out as being really interesting off the top of my head.
Well, it was a pleasure to read. I like to think I know a little bit about Oklahoma history. You read this book and you find out you don't know much at all. Jeff Smith, thanks for joining me today. He's the author of Here Today from OU Press, which was just released. And this has been the KGOU Readers Club. If you missed any of the conversation today, visit our website, kgou.org, where it is posted.